Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome back to The Midpoint. Today I'm joined by journalist and broadcaster Krishnan Gurumurthy. Krishnan is one of the lead presenters of Channel 4 News and has been part of the team since 1998, making him one of the nation's best-known news anchors. Krishnan is the second longest-serving presenter of Channel 4 News, and he also presents the accompanying podcast Ways to Change the World. He's filmed documentaries all over the globe for Unreported World, fronted big news events such as 9/11, and reported from war zones in Syria, Yemen, and Gaza. He's covered 5 British general elections to date and presented the first live autopsy on TV. Some may argue they're not so different. Add to this his stint on Strictly Come Dancing in 2023, and it strikes me that he's not a man that often turns down a challenge. And when his health was challenged in his early 50s, he radically changed his diet and lifestyle. So we're also going to be joined by Dr. Emily Porter, a specialist dietitian at the Gut Health Clinic. Emily's here to shed some light on the relationship between your gut and your overall health. But first, here's Krishnan. Krish, welcome to The Midpoint.
Very nice to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's very exciting to have you here in your suit, looking resplendent, wearing a tie, because you've hot-footed it from the midday news.
Yeah, this is very much Channel 4 News look. My days of having two heads are over. I'm just back on the news now.
I was going to say, the sequins have been banished.
Yeah, we finished the tour about a week ago. And strangely, it's been quite nice to get back to just one job.
Really?
Well, because two jobs for 6 months or 7 months is quite a lot, and much more than you imagine.
When you have to throw yourself into Strictly.
Yeah.
So inevitably, the other job's going to be slightly kind of, I don't know, not, you never neglect it, but it's never going to be your main focus, is it?
Of course, because that's the one I, you know, I've been doing a long time, so I can kind of cruise a little bit on that. So it did feel like I wasn't putting everything into that. And it's a very demanding time. So it's actually quite nice. I've been quite excited this week going back to
it. I think in a way you've done it well, because you've come out of Strictly, didn't have too long to wait till the Christmas special. So you've probably had a few weeks of work. Then you got yourself going on the tour. So it kind of eases you out. It's kind of decompressing your experience in
yes.
a way. When you leave suddenly, which everybody leaves Strictly suddenly, nobody expects to go when they go. So when you leave suddenly, there's a grief, isn't there?
It's a very weird thing. And the TV show, I think, leaves everybody slightly bereft because you've been going, as you know, at 100 miles an hour and working 8-10 hour days and training like crazy and learning new things and having an amazing time and meeting all these people and then having the stress and the emotional high and low of the Saturday night show and whether you live to fight another week or not. And then it's suddenly over and it feels unfinished. And as though you've got a lot more in you.
Mm. But so you've already started thinking about your following week.
Yeah, you've already started thinking about that. And it feels cruel and unfair. And so you then sign up to do the tour, and the tour is totally different. And it's nothing like the TV show at all. And it's basically a big show that you take on the road. And it's like doing the school play on steroids in front of 10,000 people. And it's great fun. But then when you get to the end of it, it's like, yes, you're...
My time's done.
You've done.
Yeah.
And it's a good way of getting over Strictly, I think.
I've met very, very few people who ever regretted doing Strictly. I think there's probably only a handful in the history of time who have ever even kind of vocalised that. You certainly don't seem like you'd fall into that group. You seem like someone who absolutely embraced everything Strictly had to offer.
Yeah, I totally threw myself into it. I thought the only way to do it was to do it. And you couldn't calculate and go, well, I'll do it so far and I'll only do this and I won't wear sequins and I'll be serious, you know, I've got to worry about my credibility and all that kind of stuff. You just forget about all of that. And the only way to really do and enjoy Streetly is to be 110% and just go for it. And I did. And it was, you know, what you put in, you get out. It's very, very rewarding.
And what is interesting as well, there's such a marked contrast, as there always is every year with the contestants, but you are that person that I think people want to champion because your day job is so far removed. You know, Mr. Serious, wearing a tie, talking to world leaders and other very important people.
The contrast was massive, yeah. I think it's fair to say. Yeah, and I think even though there have been lots of news people and there's usually a news person on there, they tend to come from perhaps the chattier end of news, breakfast news, morning shows, that kind of thing. And I don't think they've ever had anybody who did, I mean, you know, I do the most serious programme on the telly. And so I think the contrast was huge. And that, and they obviously loved that idea.
And a relief for you, I imagine, at a time in your life where it's time to just perhaps have that moment. It's like a reset.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I realised that at the time that I was doing it, but it became very clear as soon as I started. I think when I did it, I was really just playing around, doing something different, thought I might have some fun, thought it would last 3 or 4 weeks. You know, maybe I'd survive 2 weeks of the actual show and you have 2 weeks of training before that and it would just be a good thing to do. But as soon as you start doing it, yes, you suddenly become aware that it is this huge outlet for, you know, all these feelings and energy and type of energy that you just haven't been using in the day job. And it became very enjoyable very quickly. And so you want more of it. So you desperately try hard to stay in.
And I've read you say that it made you brave.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite hard to sort of think back into those early weeks, but I think you do just have to sort of jump off and not worry about being rubbish or being uncoordinated or being old or, you know, being any of the things that you would normally think about if somebody said, do you fancy doing Strictly as the presenter of Channel 4 News? But I think it was more that it made me think about a lot of the stuff that I'd put away since being younger. Mm. You know, when I started out in TV, I did a lot of entertainment and children's TV and youth TV and had lots of fun as well as doing quite serious stuff. But I was told to stop, basically, by the head of news.
Because you had
the
BBC, to be serious.
You know, yes, who decided that you couldn't be two things at once. And in fact, he actually said to me, you can be Bruce Forsyth or Jeremy Paxman, you can't be both. You know, take a decision. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to go down the news route and put everything else away. So it unlocked quite a lot of that fun and exhilaration from doing that kind of entertainment.
You found your
you
fun
easily
side
forget.
Again.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's partly an age thing as well, in that, you know, you get a job, you get a mortgage, you have children, everything becomes quite serious and responsible, and you stop going to nightclubs and you stop doing stupid things and you become a grown-up. And all of a sudden you're 53 and leading a very serious life and you haven't been having that much frivolous fun.
So has Fun Krish, who's now kind of had a bit of time out, he's escaped from the bottle, he's been released, is he going to stay out? Are you going to keep that person, you know, energised and fuelled?
That's the challenge. I mean, it's very hard to say at the moment because I've literally just stopped. I think, you know, carrying on the Strictly journey of doing the tour was partly about prolonging it. And now the challenge is how do you keep having fun and challenging yourself? Because I think it's also just about doing something really challenging.
Pushing yourself out
pushing
of the comfort
yourself
zones. Yeah.
Out of the comfort zone and out of the thing that you know how to do because you've been doing it for 25 years. So, yeah, I think I'll just be saying yes to a lot more and not worrying so much and, you know, giving things a try.
Because there is nothing as exposing as going on a dance floor on live TV, doing something that you're not proficient at, you know, in terms of thinking, do I look silly? Is this going to be, you know, is this going to be perceived as being terrible? You couldn't wish for a more exposing experience if you want to kind of like throw yourself into something different. So actually, any of the other things that you're asked to do, potentially,
are not going to be as intense.
No. I always use it as a kind of measure, almost like a kind of barometer. I go, well, it can't be. I can't feel as bad as I did then.
Yeah. You know,
I can't feel as scared as I did then. Nothing's ever going to feel as nerve-wracking as that did.
I mean, the nerves for me, I don't know how you found it, but they really took me by surprise. I think I hadn't really thought about it properly when I said yes to doing Strictly. And so it hadn't really occurred to me precisely what would happen. I felt nerves that I hadn't felt since I was a little kid. you know, sort of wobbly knees kind of nerves.
Proper butterflies in the stomach,
And obviously that is exhilarating in a way when you get away with it and you do well and you, you know, and you come away.
Or smash it.
And, but I hadn't really realised that that's what I was letting myself in for. So yes, I suppose once you've done Strictly, not a loss is going to be that scary. And it's funny, the things that scare me in life are sort of, they make no sense anyway, I think.
What, like what?
Well, I think, I mean, I always used to be scared of silly, you know, monsters and ghosts and supernatural stuff and not really being scared of properly dangerous things, you know, sort of, I mean, obviously you're scared of dangerous stuff, but I suppose in the course of my job, I do go to dangerous places. And, you know, I don't find that terrifying the way that you might find going on the Strictly dance floor terrifying. So what you're scared of or what you find exhilarating is a strange thing, I think, to think about.
Do you think it's because of your serious job? Do you think it's kind of the fear of looking silly?
No, I don't think it is because I don't think I worried too much about looking silly. I worried about not doing it well, not getting a good score, of being sent home that week, of being the first one out. I wasn't really worried about being silly because I think once you think I'm doing Strictly, you know, everything is sort of off the scale, absurd. So there's no point worrying about looking silly.
So there was a perfectionist in you who just wanted to be
you want to do well and you want to do as well as you possibly can. I mean, when I say, I mean, not perfectionist, because obviously I was aware of my
limitations. There's a realism.
But, you know, as well as I possibly could. And I kind of also think you want to kind of live up to what people are buying into. You know, you're
They're
kind of aware that people are kind of rooting for you and believing in you. And so you kind of want to live up to that. So I don't honestly know how I'm going to match any of that. I mean, another sort of Strictly alumni messaged me when I went out saying nothing is ever quite as sparkly as Strictly. And I really hope that's not true.
Well, because but nothing in life really is as sparkly as Strictly. But that's great because, you know, you've dipped your toe into that world and had an experience of that. But that doesn't mean it can't be as exciting and fun. It's just Strictly is like no other show on telly, and it makes people feel like no other show on telly, and it reaches an audience, you know, like no other show. So it is the absolute peak of the mountain, isn't it? It's the Mount Olympus of entertainment television.
That's the other interesting thing about the tour, actually, because you meet the Strictly, it's just Strictly fans who come to the tour. Mm. I think it tends not to be just, they're not ordinary audiences. They are people who absolutely love the TV show. And so you get a sense of sort of who's watching and what they get out of it, because obviously you meet a lot of them and
they get in touch. For you.
Yeah, you know, and through social media and all the rest of it. So you have a quite a good sense of what people enjoy about it, which again is not something I'd thought about much.
It's an escapism, isn't that?
Yeah.
And there's escapism for the audience and for the people who do the show, I think. Although it's absolutely a reality for the dancers, and you were blessed with a new dancer who I think is going to be a perennial kind of...
Lauren Oakley,
leader.
Yeah,
on
I'm
it,
sure she'll know. Do really,
she's
really
amazing.
Well. She's got a great personality.
And
she's a brilliant dancer.
That whole dynamic of being with somebody, you know, you get to your 50s, you don't spend that much time with another woman when you've been married for 20-odd years, do you? As much as you do on Strictly. It's an interesting dynamic.
Not in the same way. I mean,
push your groin into mine on day one.
Yeah. I mean you know, you get to know people on the news quite well because we go away. You know, you might go away
for 2 weeks
with somebody filming and there's only two or three of you on the team. And so you do, you know, you spend every meal together and you get to know each other, but not in the same way because you're not in this shared endeavour. And obviously you don't have that physical intimacy that you've got to get over very, very quickly.
But did you get over very, very quickly?
Yes, actually. Yeah, I did. I didn't worry too much about that.
Because they touch you. This is obviously, I've got to be careful how I say this, but they, and times have changed. It's 2007.
Yeah.
But they touch you in a way that no other job in the world could you get away with touching somebody. But it's all part of the job. And when you come from a very different work environment, I think if you've been to stage school and you've done theatre school and all that kind of thing, you're probably used to that. But that was something that I was like, oh, hello.
Yes.
So you smoke then. It was a bit like that on day one.
And I imagine much more so for women than for men, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because it is such a sort of a male-dominated thing, dance. Mm. It's...
But the man leads.
Yeah, the man leads. And it's sort of, I found it quite difficult to get my head around that, actually, for a while, because it is a really old-fashioned, male-dominated, sexist kind of
Although Strictly have tried and have succeeded very well with their same-sex couples and other kind of things they've done, I think, in terms of
Yes, although I still think there's something quite old-fashioned about the whole thing.
But there's also a comfort, I think, in that. I quite like, and I like the thing that Ginger Rogers says about doing everything that Fred Astaire did, but backwards and heels. I think everybody knows that while the man might be leading, you can see in the couples like you, where the male is the celebrity, the woman is working her socks off to make it look like you're leading.
Yes. No, I think that's true. But I think also sort of in terms of who becomes the star and who's following it and all that kind of stuff, I think it's quite male-dominated in a way that really should still change. Mm. You know, if you think about this, the people who've, the professionals who go through Strictly and then who get careers elsewhere or their own TV
And interestingly,
show,
you say that.
Tends to be the men.
Shirley Ballas's Desert Island Discs, and she spoke very strongly about how she's been treated in an overt sexist way in the industry. That's the ballroom industry. This is not Latin ballroom. This is not the Strictly TV show industry. she's clearly as head judge got a lot of power.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
But let's talk about the physical morphing of Krish, because this started long before you started on the show, or not long before, but months before. You had a bit of an epiphany with your health and well-being.
It's almost exactly a year ago, really. I've got lots of things wrong with me, which I revealed in the course of doing Strictly in a way that I never would have done before either. I sort of kind of thought, well, to hell with all my sort of, you know, hang-ups about privacy and keeping everything quiet. But you know, I've got a heart condition. I was far too overweight. I have got a history of Crohn's disease, which is not active, but I have had it. And then I also had a pre-diabetic blood test, where the GP said, "Well, look, you know, if you carry on like this, you are going to have diabetes, and that has lots and lots of things that you really don't want, lots of complications. So you've got to do something about it." And I didn't really do anything about it. I'd had that. Instruction about 6 to 9 months before.
Why did you not take that advice on board?
I don't know. I just sort of, I was slightly hiding under the duvet around the whole thing. And just
what did Lisa say, your wife? I think I'd be quite cross if Kenny had that and didn't change his...
Yeah, I think she... Well, I suppose because I've generally not addressed all the things, you know, all of the other things in my life also mean that I ought to have a much healthier diet, I ought to have a much healthier lifestyle, I ought to have been much more active, but I wasn't. So I suppose Lisa was just a bit sort of like, well, look, you know, you've got to do it. It's, you know, I can't make you do it. And it was, I don't know why precisely, but we were just talking about me getting a grip. And I was probably going through a slightly self-loathing phase of kind of thinking, oh God, look at you, you look terrible and you feel terrible. And every so often I think that happens to me where I would just kind of feel decrepit.
How long did they last, those kind of bouts of feeling?
A few months maybe.
Really?
Of just kind of like going, you know, you're sort of on the one way escalator or travelator to being just kind of decrepit and useless and unhealthy.
So that can't have done much good for your self-esteem.
No, but I suppose you make up for it in other ways, you know, especially in a job like mine, it's quite easy to compensate for a lack of physical confidence. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't, you know, I wasn't down or depressed or anything, but I didn't have very high physical self-esteem. And every so often, you know, you would think, well, maybe I ought to do something about it.
Did you start diets? And
No, I mean, the only physical thing I've done in my life over the last 12 years now is a bike ride, which I don't do every year, but I've done quite a lot of them. And it's a bike ride for a charity that I'm now chairman of that was started by a close friend of mine whose son is the same age as my son and who has a muscular dystrophy called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And so every summer we do a 24-hour bike ride from London to Paris.
I think I might have known you when you did the first one, actually.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, you did. And so, and that was the first physical challenge I've done as an adult.
And you carried on doing that every year?
And I've tended to do it, well, most years, although I've had some years where I was injured and couldn't do it for all sorts of reasons. But I'd become less and less conscientious about training for that, so I might just train for like 6 weeks, 8 weeks or something like that. And the rest of the year...
So you literally dust your bike down,
yeah,
train for it, do it, and then...
And then put it away. Because I wasn't somebody who particularly enjoyed going out cycling every Sunday morning or anything like that. I was just doing it to raise money, and that needed to change. Mm. So, yeah, it was around this time last year that I just kind of thought, I can't give up yet, sort of I'm too young to just kind of give up on everything at this stage. So I ought to just at least try and lose weight. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard about this, what is it, a clinic or a health resort or whatever you might call it in Austria, which a couple of friends of mine had been to years ago. And it's the kind of place that people go to every year. Mm. Rich people with too much money and not
too
enough time and all the rest of it. Well, not enough time because they tend to just go for like, 1 week or 2 weeks to kind of
redress,
decompress
their,
and
their
put
problems.
Their phone away. Would go to and have a sort of a detox, and it's the Meyer Clinic. And I was talking about it, and that was where Lisa kind of came in, my wife, because I was talking about it, and before I knew it...
You were on a plane to Austria.
It was sort of booked, and I was on a plane, and that was my ticket, and it was like, right, go away. And there is a Michael McIntyre sketch where he talks about having done this with... And his wife took a very similar role in which, he jokes about her sort of putting the ticket in his hand and saying... go away and come back better looking. And that was sort of, that was sort of what happened with me as well. And I remember just kind of the day I was going, don't quite know how this happened, but somehow I'm on a plane to Slovenia and then driving across the border to Austria to this place on my own. And it was suddenly a bit scary, but it felt good.
So you had a few weeks there?
Well, I had 1 week there.
All right.
And it's just a massive detox. You go on this... very low-calorie diet, very, very simple food, but balanced food. It's a balanced diet. It's not a sort of a faddish thing. It's not sort of all protein or anything like that. And you see doctors and you have tests and they look into your food allergies or intolerances and tell you the things that you should cut out of your life. And you do a little bit of mild exercise, but not very much because you don't have much energy because you're living off about 500 calories a day.
Right, so it's not about the exercise, really. It's about the food.
Food.
And what your intolerance
is. And clearing out your system, basically. Mm. And you just have this week which gets you going. Mm. And they kind of explain the method and what's going on. And they teach you to chew your food slowly and... do all of that kind of thing. There's a lecture on how to eat a raisin for 10 minutes.
Wow.
Or how to spend 10 minutes eating a raisin and how it changes taste in your mouth and all of that. And so you come home and you do another 2 weeks of it in a slightly more relaxed way. So I probably went to a 1,000-calorie a day.
And you lost, presumably,
diet.
A lot of weight through this.
Lost a lot of weight that way. So I lost almost 2 stone, I think, that way.
And felt better.
Felt great. Mm. Yeah. Because you
noticed your energy?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You feel good. Your skin looks good. Everyone says you look younger. You feel lighter. You're doing exercise that suddenly feels easier. So you're getting on the bike or you're going to the gym and everything feels easier because you are lighter. Mm. Obviously, it's just kind of obvious. And as soon as you lose that weight, you kind of go, yes, why didn't I think about that before?
And was it easy to stick to the principles, the central tenets of this way of life?
Well, I mean, it's essentially intermittent fasting. So... it was about shifting the day to eat breakfast, a proper lunch, and then basically no dinner. So I would have a soup or a very low-calorie, light meal quite early on in the day, around 6 o'clock, before the news. And then
before had the habit of coming home and eating after?
Yeah, I would always come home and eat at 9 o'clock or 9:30, and it's the worst thing in the world to have a big meal at that time of day. And so, yeah, that was the shift. And it's not easy to maintain.
But you feel it's worth it.
But at that point, I found it easy. Yeah, I found it easy all the way through last year until we got Strictly. Because as soon as you're doing Strictly, you're doing that kind of exercise.
Burning so many more thousands of calories a day.
You're just eating all the time just to keep going. And so that's when my regime went out.
But did you stick to healthy eating when you were doing Strictly, or did you find yourself?
Not really, I have to say, because you just eat what's there.
Yeah.
You know, and dancers seem to eat terribly. I mean, it's sort of, there's loads of sugar and
I think because they're burning so many calories, aren't they? So they're probably not thinking too much. And they're young, Chris.
They're young,
let's not
exactly.
forget. They're in their 20s.
Exactly.
You know?
So they don't care, and it's fine. And they can be healthy when they want to be healthy. But they will often eat late as well. Mm. So I would sometimes do the news and then go back to training at about 8:30 and do about an hour and a half more. And so you're finishing at 10, you're getting home at 11. And you're hungry.
Yeah.
So the regime went out the window during Strictly, and I'm now trying to get it back, basically.
Because you've realised that, having kind of denied it almost for all those years, that actually you feel better.
Oh, it
you
made
look
me
better.
Feel much, much better.
And then your self-esteem presumably has improved.
Yeah. No, obviously it's nice
you're
being
looking
told.
At yourself in the mirror thinking, oh, I look pretty good.
Exactly. And you don't want to get too hung up on that. But
No, but it's good if you can see the rewards, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think especially in our game on the telly, it is nice to feel that you kind of don't look terrible.
Yeah.
And I got into that place where a lot of, you know, especially with social media these days, a lot of people would just say, oh, you're so fat. Fat would become a sort of a term of abuse or whatever along the way of criticising something else that you've done. Mm. And you would just get used to that and think, well, it's fine. I'm just another one of those
statistics.
Old fat, serious guys on the telly. I don't need to be good looking. And it's quite nice when people say, oh, you look great, or you know.
So what did your kids think?
They were really pleased, I think, because they are probably more worried about my health issues now that I've talked about them and told them more about them, which I never had before. Mm. So, yes, I think they are much happier for me to be looking after myself and caring about how
I live. Have you had another test regarding the pre-type 2 diabetes?
I haven't. I haven't done anything since doing Strictly because you don't have time. But yes, I had a test before Strictly and it had come down. But I should probably have another one now.
And what about the heart condition is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy?
Yes.
Is that right? And you live with that, you manage that.
That's something that you have tests for every year or 2 years.
I have just to check the heart's not thickening.
To see how it's it's changing as a muscle. And I don't have it very serious. I have it very, I have a very, very mild form of the disease, but it's just one of those things that's progressive. And my dad has it, and he's got like a sort of a pacemaker fitted under his chest, which is a defibrillator. Mm-hmm. So that would shock him back into a regular heartbeat if his heart went into atrial fibrillation, it's called, where it just kind of tremors. And one day I might have to have that if it gets worse. I've had a couple of cousins who have died as a result of the condition prematurely, one in his 20s and one in his 50s. So it's just one of those things you keep tabs on and you have to keep testing. I generally feel a lot fitter, and so I think and a lot more bold about what I can do. So
weights, that's the midlife key to success, weights and strength training, so that you kind of keep those bones and muscles strong. And all the experts we've ever had on the 100 episodes or so who kind of work in this area say it's never too late to start lifting. So, and lifting doesn't mean going to kind of, an Arnold Schwarzenegger style gym and, lifting massive Olympic barbells.
Yeah.
You can use all kinds of different resistance, but that seems to be everybody's, kind of one go-to in midlife.
Yes. So, well, I mean, the one thing I discovered in the last year was Pilates.
Which is also amazing.
Brilliant.
And it's resistance because of using your
And then a little bit of weight training alongside that.
Magic combination. Do you know, this seems like a really good time to bring in our expert, specialist dietitian, Dr. Emily Porter. Hello, Emily.
Hello, Gabby. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Good to meet you both.
Thank you so much for coming on. You're just listening in to Chris talking there about his midlife reset, I think you'd call it. And a lot of people listening, I think, will be very inspired by that, because he said a few things, I think, that are really interesting, whether or not it was going to be too late. And he'd almost just let himself go on the travelator, as he called it, kind of just carrying on with unhealthy habits and just seeing, kind of what happens. And actually putting a stop to all of that is a brave and bold and sometimes difficult thing for people to do. Not everybody is going to head off to Austria. But there's a lot we can do with our gut health and our diet, isn't there? So if somebody's listening and they're feeling a little bit like that, is the low calorie diet, is that restriction, is that the best way to start?
Definitely. And I think there's some really interesting bits that have come up from sort of what Chris has spoken about with his experience at the Mayo Clinic, and little bits of it, like you say, Gabby, that we can pull out and apply to our daily life without having to go maybe quite as far as Chris did at Mayo Clinic, because like you say, it has to be sustainable. It has to become a long-term habit and fit into our daily routine as well. Definitely in terms of things like the meal timing. If we take out the sort of the intake of calories for the moment, I mean, there's been some really interesting work done. I think it was Tel Aviv University who gave people the same amount of calories to eat. Some people had more of these calories earlier in the day. Some people ate more later in the day. And actually the group that had more front-loaded meals had around an 18% decrease in blood sugar levels through the day. Because our body is more sensitive to insulin, so the hormone that helps regulate our blood sugar levels, in the morning. And definitely when we're looking at gut health as well, having those few hours before bed to give our body time to digest food, to let it empty out the stomach, has some really good benefits for almost that gut rest and reset overnight. Where Chris was talking about that intermittent fasting period doesn't necessarily have to be a prolonged fasting period. It can simply be bringing that eating window earlier a little bit.
You know, people often talk about the Mediterranean diet being a great diet, but I've just been in Spain for a few days and the Mediterranean diet is amazing, but people do eat it very late. You know, we'd have dinner at 8 and we were the only people in the restaurant. They still love their late evening meals. So is it the kind of food as well that you're putting inside? Say you had to, like Chris just described there, coming home from training after he'd done the news, feeling hungry. If you had to have something before you went to bed, are there certain foods that are going to react better for your gut and for your insulin and, you know, blood sugar levels?
Definitely. And I think it's a really interesting point. It goes back to what we were saying at the beginning. It has to be something that fits into your lifestyle. And actually, food is more than just fuel and nutrition. It's also social, cultural, emotional, all the other things that come sort of wrapped up with diet. I think definitely if we are eating later at night, going for something that is potentially a little bit easier to digest. So not high fat, high sugar meal, for example. There is some evidence suggesting the higher protein food can maybe help with sleep overnight, but definitely when we're looking at things like gut health and eating for managing blood sugar levels as well, fiber intake is really, really important. And I think this is one of the key components of a more Mediterranean style diet pattern as well. So lots of whole grains, lots of beans and pulses, lots of fruit and veg in there, so definitely including lots of those plant derived types of fiber in there is going to be beneficial for gut health and also for sort of blood sugar management as well. So if we look at things like beans and pulses, for example, we know they're a great source of fibre for the gut bacteria. All the bugs in our large intestine like different types of fibre. Beans and pulses can be a really good thing to fuel them with. Also for things like blood sugar levels, we know beans and pulses have something called the second meal effect. So not only are they helpful for managing blood sugar levels then and there, but potentially even into the next day as well. So if you are eating something late at night, what can we pack in there to make sure that it's still a nutritious, balanced meal, I guess?
It's also having things sometimes when you've got to eat late at night, having things prepared, isn't it? So, you know, whether it's something like a little bean salad that you've done earlier in the day, when you come in, you're more likely to nibble on that than if you haven't got that and you see a big loaf of sourdough and think, oh, I might just smash a load of jam on that, or, you know, and that's the worst thing you can probably have before you go to sleep. So I think prep is everything, isn't it? Which sometimes seems a bit tedious, but actually will save you in the long run.
The killer is alcohol, though, isn't it?
Yeah, alcohol, yeah. Late at night.
Yeah, and as soon as you have alcohol, you then want to eat
a snack. Yeah. Because somehow psychologically you think that the snack's going to take away the alcohol from you. I always feel like, oh, if I eat something with it, the alcohol won't affect my sleep somehow. Yeah. It'll kind of suck up the alcohol.
That is the single thing that makes keeping any regime really, really harder.
How and also, if you get into the habit of reading the news and then having a glass of wine, you know, that's the habit, I think. How hard was that to break when you come back from Austria?
Really, really hard. I mean, I had to, I stopped drinking as well for 2 or 3 weeks, and then sort of life is too short to not have a glass of wine. So I started drinking again, but not but trying to just be aware of it and, yeah. and compensating. I think that, you know, because going out for dinner is also quite a big part of my life.
Yeah.
So deciding not to have dinner is not realistic 7 days a week. But I would try and compensate. If I knew I was going to go out for dinner, I wouldn't have a big lunch, or I would shift my breakfast time the next day or whatever it is.
I think that is the thing, isn't it? It's the plan of the week. You look ahead and you think, right, well, there's going to be a couple of nights here where I'd like to have a drink and I'd like to have a nice meal with friends that might mean my food's after 8 o'clock. So on the other days, being a bit more careful. I want to ask you a bit about the test that Krish had to find out that he was potentially pre-type 2 diabetic. And what does that look like? You know, what? How does one know that that is needed or might happen?
And I think that's it's a really interesting question, because there's a lot in the media and a lot of buzz around things like continuous glucose meters, for example, the little sensors that people are wearing on their arms that are looking at blood sugars in the short term. But in terms of looking at diagnosing diabetes, the test that Krish had, the blood test, is for something called HbA1c, which is basically a medium-term measure of what your blood sugar levels are doing. So they look at essentially the amount of glucose attached to your red blood cells over a three-month period and look at where that sits. And then we've got certain cutoffs for where that falls within a pre-diabetic range or where it would fall into a diagnosis of diabetes. But the good news is, as we've already touched upon, as we've gone through, you can bring that down. You can put a diagnosis of type 2 into remission, or you can bring it back down into the pre-diabetic range.
You know, not so long ago, people would have been put onto drugs straight away or told that this was irreversible almost. And actually, there's been a lot of studies showing that you can, not just the pre, but also a diagnosis of type 2 can be reversed.
Yeah, definitely. And I think some of the risk factors for diabetes are things that are outside our control. So things like genetics, ethnicity, age. Also, so many of them are things that we can modify. So diet, lifestyle, not just thinking about the foods that we're eating, but things like stress levels that can impact blood sugar levels, and things like how we're sleeping, how well we're moving, things like hormones as well. Unfortunately, as women, as our estrogen levels drop, our sensitivity to insulin is likely to decrease a little bit as well. But lots of things we can do in terms of slightly changing what we eat and how we eat and how we live our lives that we can do to work alongside those changes as well. And absolutely possible for a lot of people, not for everybody, but for a lot of people to put that diabetes into remission or to bring
it's believing it's out. Possible though, that I think is really important. I mean, when I got my pre-diabetic diagnosis, the GP gave me a couple of books, pamphlets, and they were about how you need to have a very low calorie diet to try and reverse this. And it said, try and have an 800 calorie diet for a number of weeks. Mm. And I remember looking at this thinking, that's just totally impossible. If I think about my calorific intake, there's no way I could do that. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't do anything about it, because I didn't think it was realistic that I'd be able to do that. But actually, obviously, when I went to Austria, I went on to 500 calories a day. And that, I'm not saying it is not good to need to have to go and pay to go to a very expensive clinic to be prove, you know, to have something
to prove it wrong.
But in my case, that's what happened. You know, I sort of actually you can, and therefore after that you can carry it on. But I think there is something that they need to improve about the way they tell people that this is possible, because if you just think about a burger or a glass of wine or a, you know, and any normal sort of piece of food that you might have during the course of
you've
the day,
almost taken your calories.
That's it. Yeah. You've done it in one meal. Or, you know, not even one meal sometimes.
I think the health messaging, and I was about to actually kind of bring this up actually in terms of age, you waited until you were kind of into your 50s to make this change. But actually the health messaging kind of, and I know it's never too late to address your health, but it's that build up, and especially for women, I think, towards menopause as well, that you know, if you can get hold of these things in your 40s, you know, the younger you are, it's going to be probably easier to break cycles and make changes.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's one of the things that the NHS are starting to do now, which is bringing it back to focus a little bit more on prevention and being a little bit more proactive rather than reactive, which is definitely something that we can do as individuals as well. And definitely making some of those changes earlier on. If we look at onset of menopause, for example, eating more oily fish has been associated with delaying menopause onset for about 3 years. Eating 75 grams of fresh beans or pulses every day might delay onset of menopause by a year. So lots of those changes that we can think about making slightly earlier on, as Chris was saying, things like resistance training and strength training, as you were saying as well, Gabby. We know that our bone density starts to decrease, scarily, from about in our 30s. Mm. So even from that point, starting to focus on things like strength training, making sure that we're getting enough calcium and vitamin D, I think are really important in terms of, I guess, future-proofing our health and expanding or prolonging our health span, not necessarily our lifespan, but also the length of time that we're staying fit and healthy and independent for.
Thank you so much, Emily. Great having you on The Midpoint. And I'm just thinking, Chris, your other hat on as a news reader and news hound and journalist, in terms of what the NHS is doing with this. I haven't had it personally, but I've heard quite a few people, including my mum, having calls from her GP to go in and just have some tests. And that proactiveness, for me, is the thing that the piece in the puzzle, if you like, of our societal health that has just got to become more prevalent for everybody, you know, getting in there earlier with people. Okay, you haven't been to the doctors. This is the reason they said to my mum, you haven't been to the doctors for years. They were a bit suspicious about why. We just want to take some readings. And she found out, actually, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, that her cholesterol was a little bit high. And they immediately offered her, oh gosh, what are they called?
Statins.
Statins, yes. And she said, well, can I change my diet? And they said, yes. So she said, I'd rather do that. And so she's really conscious now. She wasn't overweight particularly, but she does like, you know, some naughty things in her diet. And she's really conscious about it now and is eating so much better. But that all came through the proactiveness of the health service, looking at her and going, we haven't seen her for a long time. So what, you know, what's going on there? And I think politically, you know, wouldn't you be, whatever party you are, that's something that you would be pushing.
I mean, the health service has been talking about more preventative medicine for as long as I can remember. But
actually doing it?
Yeah, I think there is more going on now, but I think partly just because the conversation's changed anyway. So things that we're talking about that would have been regarded as ridiculous and faddish and just for either crazies or people with more money than sense, even maybe 15 years ago, is now mainstream and sensible. And so I think the whole tenor of the conversation around diet, health, exercise, even things like intolerances and the number of people who are ordering oat milk instead of dairy and all that kind of stuff, is just all for the better. And I think that, you know,
where are you though on things like actually policing that and the nanny state, not, you know, sugar taxes or actually taking those foods away from people's, you know, kind of eyeline almost? And
well, I mean, in terms of policy, obviously I just have to stay neutral and not give an opinion, but I mean, I think that conversation will happen a lot more. But the question is how you do it. It's the difference between things that seem punitive and actually getting food manufacturers to reformulate through regulation and just take sugar, you know, the amount of sugar out of chocolate bars or ready meals or that kind of stuff. It's probably just as effective as the more sort of sledgehammer nanny state kind of measures. So I think we'll see a lot more of it generally.
So the Krishna Guru Murphy that sits here now, to the one a year ago before you went on your health journey and your Strictly journey, compare the two. I mean, that's quite the contrast, I think, in a year. Not just the physical and the outside, but everything that's gone on inside.
Yeah, no, it's quite hard to put myself back there in a way, and I don't particularly want to. It's not that I was unhappy, but I think I was really in a rut and I'd sort of given up on myself a little bit. So I think I realise now that you can, first of all, you can change quite a lot in quite a short period of time. So that's quite inspiring.
Very inspiring.
You can feel very differently physically, and that will change the way you feel emotionally. And you can think about your life in a slightly different way. You can sort of feel slightly more hopeful. I mean, I think...
You got your mojo back.
A little bit. I mean, I slightly inherited. I think, you know, I grew up with my dad has, you know, kind of either joked or talked about the fact that he was going to die since I was about 8. And so it's always been a kind of, like, oh, you know, I'll be dead and gone by then, you know, when he was sort of talking about his 60s or his 70s or his 80s. And he's now 90 and still works for the NHS.
Wow.
And he's still going. And so the joke has become, well, you're still here, you know. Yeah.
Wrong again.
But so I think I grew up with that and I probably inherited a bit of it and I'd started doing the same thing. I think I'd sort of done that same sort of shtick. With the kids about, well, I'll be dead and gone by then, and, you know, mum can find a new husband and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. And And part of it was a joke, and part, you know, was just a sort of a way of talking, and part of it was sort of true. And I kind of thought, well, I've got all these things wrong with me. One of them's going to get me sooner or later. And I don't really think like that now. I kind of think, well, there's actually no reason why you can't not stop them, because they are just things that you have, but you can mitigate them. Mm. You can be sensible. You can enjoy life and you can feel younger. And I think that's the thing, I feel younger.
Yeah. You look younger.
Than I did a year ago. That's probably the biggest and easiest way to describe it.
You have reversed the aging process biologically, I'm sure, because of the metrics will show that, won't they? Because of your diet. And that is the perceived kind of wisdom in science, that, you know, by doing those things that you've done, it is inspiring, Krish. And I'm sure many people listening to this will feel motivated by hearing your story. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having
me. Sharing it today. And best of luck with everything going forward. I would like to see what that thing is that fills the Strictly hole over the next few years. Watch this space.
Well, the next immediate thing is the bike ride, which is in May, so I've got to get back on the bike.
And a great charity as well, Duchenne's. I'm president of Muscular Dystrophy UK, so I know a lot about Duchenne's. So good luck with that, with the bike riding, and maybe keep it up a little bit through the year.
Yes.
Maybe. I mean, all that gorgeous gear, the Lycra, you can't...
You may as well keep it.
Yeah, you might as well. Thank you. It was so lovely to catch up with Krish, and I'm so glad that Fun Krish has been revived and is hopefully here to stay. And I really admire the way he's taken control of his health again at this time of life, because like he said, actually, you can prioritise your health and it doesn't have to involve a full detox retreat, although that did sound lovely. The things that Dr. Emily Porter's spoken about may be a good place to start, so a huge thanks to her as well. Thanks to Krish, to Spiritland Creative, and to you for keeping me company. I'll be back next Wednesday with another brilliant guest to discuss all things midlife. Bye-bye for now.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.